This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses. Season 21, Episode 3. This is Writing Excuses.
Deconstructing Plots.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Erin.
And we are going to be talking about the other big thread that we're going to be running through the whole year. So, deconstructing plots, what does that even mean? There's this thing that you'll see with food where they're like, this is a deconstructed peanut butter sandwich, where they get into like what the essence of things are. So I've been thinking a lot about like what the salt, fat, acid, heat of plot structure is. And what we're going to be doing this year is we are going to be digging into a bunch of different plot structures, looking at why they work, and then looking at the individual components of things that go into story. So, because, I mean, there are so many plot structures out there, but you know, flashing back to all of our metaphors, they're just recipes. Mm-hmm. So what are the underlying principles that they all have in common that lead us to things like the inciting incident or the dark night of the soul? Like, what are those things?
I'm really excited for this season. And as soon as you pitched it, I was like very in on it. And I'm in on it for a contrary reason, because I don't really believe in plot structure. And so, you know, I think there's a thing about doing this podcast and about teaching, which is whenever I'm asked to teach a class or we're talking about the seasons, I love doing it about something I don't really understand, which is contrary because, like, if I'm going to teach it, I should probably know about it. But sometimes the act of digging into teaching it gets my head around it in a way that I hadn't before. So when you were talking about, like, let's deconstruct plots, I was like, hell yes, let's go. Because it's a thing that I don't feel like I have a really great handle on, right? Like, obviously, I can tell when a story is slow. I can tell when the story structure isn't hitting in all these different ways. But for me, I always round it up to, oh, plot descends from character. That's like my one rule about plot, is that plot descends from character. It's not helpful in 90% of situations where we need to talk about plot. So anyways, this is just me saying, A, I'm going to be the audience surrogate here being like, what do we mean? What does that mean? And then B, I'm just excited, really excited to dig into this. Yeah.
I think I'm really similar, actually, so we can fight over who can be the audience. Sorry. Like, I like plot. It's there. It's in a story.
It's obviously important.
You know, but I think it is interesting in that I think over-index away from plot.
Yeah.
Thinking back to my sort of soap opera roots, like, soap operas are such, like, they're on every day. And so there are days in which, like, nothing really happens except a few, maybe there's a conversation and somebody looks good in a dress. And then there are days in which everyone gets slapped, which are fun. But knowing how to link from one of those events to the next, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I sort of feel like, to go back to a different metaphor, not mine, fashion, I sometimes feel this way about clothing. Like, I can say this thing looks good at the Met Gala and this one does not to me. Mm-hmm. But if you ask me why, and then you ask somebody who actually understands clothes why, like, they would be like, oh, it's this cut, it's this line, it's the whatever. It's that long speech from
Devil Wears Prada
where the character, who's it, Meryl Streep?
Cerulean.
Yeah, she explains like all the things that go into you deciding to wear this blue top. And I don't understand a lot of that. And instead I'm working on instinct, which is great when you're just wanted to say which one looks better. But if you're home trying to figure out how to dress yourself and you don't understand any of the underlying principles, you might be like, oh, this looked good on this person, but not on me. And I don't understand why. I just have to keep trying.
Yeah. And especially if you are early in your career and you don't trust your own taste, and then you are second guessing yourself all the time before you go out the door to a party.
Yeah.
And so I started off when I was writing, I know people have heard me say this before, that I understood character, like, that was a thing from theater that I understood. But I would write really good, like, stories that had a really good beginning, a really good middle, and a really good end to three completely different stories that just happened to have the same set of characters. So structure and plot was the thing that I really focused on. And one of the mistakes that I made, I think, early on, was that I thought plot was just about the action, the things that happened. And plot isn't. It's, you know, when you say plot descends from character, Rebecca Roanhorse describes this as there's an action plot and there's an emotion plot. Yeah, which is really interesting. So she thinks that when that the failure mode of an action plot is some of this. Sometimes you'll see this in science fiction, early career stuff, mm-hmm. where there's so many things happening, but you don't understand why any of it's important.
Totally. Yeah.
So they've focused on the action too much, and they've forgotten the emotion.
Yeah.
And the failure mode of the emotion plot you'll see in some literary fiction where they focus so much on the emotion that like nothing happens. So both of those things are important. But you're right. How do we do these things? The thing for me is something that I always go back to, which is that I do just want to write on instinct. I do just mm-hmm. want to do the art of it. But the idea that technique exists for when the art isn't there. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that people need to be thinking about these things all the time. The reason we keep saying tools, not rules, is that it's nice to have a toolbox. And you know, you can, like, I can improvise a meal in a kitchen, but I didn't start off improvising a meal. Started off following recipes. When I started writing, I didn't start off improvising a plot structure. Like, some of my early structures, if you look at it, like, my first sale is Rapunzel, you know? And it's like hitting those beats. Like, there's a lot of things where I borrowed someone else's plot mm-hmm. structure. And I think that we do that when it's like, oh, I love this thing that so-and-so wrote and I want to write a book like that. It's like, yeah, you want to copy their recipe, which mm-hmm. is like, there's nothing wrong with that. You can improvise around that. You can add your own details and flourishes. This isn't, hey, everybody, everything should be original and new. It's like, I think there are actually things.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about the way you're talking about plot is it's like, I was like, maybe I like plot more than I think. Because I often think about arcs and through lines mm-hmm. in a piece, which, like, if that is just also, when you talk about an emotion plot, I'm like, oh, I'm often thinking about what's the emotional through line or what's, like, the knowledge through line? Like, when, who knows what, when, and why, and how does it affect them? But I never think of that as plot. I think because I often associate plot as being rules, not tools.
Uh-huh.
Like, I often think of plot as, like, you must do these six things in this exact order or else you have broken everything. And I hate that.
Yeah, and I think one thing that I think about a lot of time with those, you know, the rules of plot is those are very culturally defined, mm-hmm. too, right? Like, I'm someone who, you know, certainly when it comes to my taste in movies, I'm notorious for liking the slowest, most glacially paced thing imaginable, you know, like when you were talking about like the, it's a failure of, you know, the action plot, if they focus too much on the emotion out. And I just thought immediately of like three of my favorite films that I would describe as literally nothing happens in this movie. A man cleans bathrooms for 2 hours and then I'm crying and I'm like, this is a perfect movie. But also that movie is made by a Western director, but is about a Japanese man, takes place in Japan, and is using non-Western plot structures, mm-hmm. right? And so to say that it is plotless is only from a perspective of a Western audience member who's expecting hero's journey, who's expecting certain kinds of beats and structures. And instead, what I'm being fed is a really different structure. So when I watch Wong Kar-wai, when I watch, you know, Korean cinema, these kind of things are pulling from very different rhythms and expectations.
Like, you know, there's this rule that a story must have a character with a problem. And a story must have conflict. And I push against that so hard because like one of my favorite stories, and I think one of the perfect stories out there is Ray Bradbury's There Will Come Soft Rain. And there's like, where, show me the character with a problem and the action. Like there's not. You can make an argument for, you know, for the house, but really no. And
at the beginning of the house, the story, the house is sad and lonely. At the end of the story, the house is sad and lonely. Nothing changes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. A character does not have to undergo change. Sherlock Holmes doesn't undergo change.
Yep.
So, but those stories are still engaging. And I think that there are reasons that they're still engaging. Like what draws us in? And so the thing for me, when you were talking, Aaron, about through lines and arcs, the thing that I've been thinking about is, well, what pulls us through a story? And we talk about a hook, and you have different hooks to attract. I'm going to actually use the fishing metaphor instead of my sheep.
Not the sheep.
For listeners, I previously confessed that I had for years thought that it was talking about a shepherd's hook instead of a fishing hook to move the sheep around. But it, when you're fishing, you've got a hook, you've got different lures on that to, and different lures depending on what you're trying to catch, depending on what your intentions are. So I think with when we're looking at fiction, it's a lot of the same thing. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the kinds of areas that we're going to be poking at for the rest of the season.
Small business life means hustling and figuring it all out, a lot of times on your own. But you don't have to spend your evenings guessing at tax forms or tracking down onboarding docs. Gusto handles all of that so you can spend your time on the parts of your business you actually love. Gusto is online payroll and benefit software built for small businesses. It's all-in-one, remote-friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. Automatic payroll tax filing, simple direct deposits, health benefits, commuter benefits, workers' comp, 401k, you name it, Gusto makes it simple and has options for nearly every budget. It's quick and simple to switch to Gusto. Just transfer your existing data to get up and running fast. Plus, don't pay a cent until you run your first payroll. Try Gusto today at gusto.com/WX and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/WX. One more time, gusto.com/WX. Therapy can help, but sometimes it isn't the whole answer. Talkiatry gives you access to real psychiatric care with licensed clinicians who can diagnose and prescribe medication if it's right for you. It's a simple way to get effective treatment right from home. Talkiatry is a 100% online psychiatry practice that provides comprehensive evaluations, diagnoses, and ongoing medication management for conditions like ADHD, anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, PTSD, insomnia, and more. All their 600-plus clinicians are in-network with major insurers, so you can use your existing insurance instead of paying monthly subscriptions or out-of-network fees. You'll meet with an experienced, licensed psychiatrist who takes the time to understand what's going on, builds a personalized treatment plan, and can prescribe medication when it's right for you. Your care stays consistent and evidence-based. Getting started with Talkiatry takes just a few minutes. Complete a short online assessment, get matched with clinicians who fit your needs, and schedule your first visit in days, not months. Head to talkiatry.com/WX and complete the short assessment to get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes. That's talkiatry.com/WX to get matched in minutes.
Where I live, the new year brings colder days. Regardless of my New Year's resolutions, my wardrobe should resolve to keep me cozy. And thanks to Quince, it's doing just that. A couple of months back, I picked up a plush cotton crew neck sweater for $50, and it is still my favorite. I have other sweaters, but this is the one I reach for. Quince can bundle you up in more than just sweaters. They've got down jackets, wool coats, Italian leather outerwear that's warm on the inside, even when it's really cold outside. Each piece is made from premium materials by trusted manufacturers that meet rigorous standards for craftsmanship and ethical production. By partnering directly with these folks, Quince provides top-quality clothing at a fraction of the price of luxury brands. Refresh your winter wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/WX for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/WX.
Okay, welcome back. So, what are some things that you can look forward to? Are we going to be talking about beginnings? Yes. We look at the other two and they're like, I haven't looked at the outline for the season.
Wait, you want us to know the structure of the season? Right, yeah. We just said we're not structured people. Right.
But we through line.
Yeah. But I think that like one of the few things that stories have in common is beginning, middle, end.
Yeah.
If for no other reason then you start reading it and then you stop reading it. Like there's
like, yeah.
So looking at what are some things that are consistent when you're looking at all of these different structures? Mm-hmm. We're going to be looking at middles, like People talk about the saggy middle. What are all the things? Like, mm-hmm. most of the story actually happens in the middle.
It's most of the book, yes.
Yeah.
So,
but it's not the part that everyone remembers the most right. usually, right? So what's actually happening there? Mm-hmm. What makes it effective? And how do you keep people moving through it? These are all really, really important questions.
Yeah.
And I assume the ending at some point, we will definitely talk we'll about talk, that.
We'll definitely
and how
talk
does
about...
it land? It's funny, like how much an ending can like taint or make a story. Mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. think about, weirdly, two endings that I really love that other people did not like, which are the ending of Lost. And the ending of Mass Effect 3, which, like, the only person in history.
Both of these are, like, heretical takes.
Don't at me. Yeah.
But my chaotic one is I really love the ending of Sunshine, you know, this Danny Boyle movie that everyone loves the first half and hates second half. And I'm like, I don't know. I think the whole thing works.
Yeah, but it's interesting thinking about, like, why do those things work? Like, for me, Lost works because the ending is an emotional ending, and I cared more about the emotional content than the solving puzzles content of that particular piece. Mm-hmm. So it hit me in the heart. It didn't need to hit me in the head.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And for, I can't remember why I liked Mass Effect 3, but I remember being like, people are very mad, but I like these pretty
people
colors.
People were too mad. It is still insane to say that you liked that ending. people need to calm down.
But I do think it's really interesting to think about, like, how do we do that? Because what's unfortunate, I think, about the reason I picked those examples are there two things where people never talk about the rest of it anymore. Yeah. They only talk about the ending. Yeah. And so if people are going to over-index on the ending, what does that mean that you have to do as a writer in order to not have them only be talking about that?
Totally.
Right. And also the fact that I think one of the reasons that people are mad about both of those is that they broke a rule.
Yes.
Mm. And so deciding when you're going to break it. We do talk about tools, not rules, but the fact is that people have expectations. And a lot of these rules arose because someone reverse engineered something that they did by accident.
Yeah.
Other people were like, oh, that's the way it should always be. And then an audience will over index on, well, that's the way it must be. But the other reason is that when you do that reverse engineering, when you figure out, well, what did I do? How did I get to this point? That a lot of times it is because it created a specific effect.
Yeah.
And so if you've used all the tools at the beginning to set up one effect, it's like, this is the effect I'm going to give you. Mm-hmm. And then they are disappointed in that. That's where the disconnect happens.
Yeah.
So I think we've talked last season a little bit when Aaron was talking about the chapter that's going in our craft book, Now Go Write, about breaking rules. If you understand the effect of this thing, then you can decide how you're going to use it.
It's signaling that you meant to break that rule. Mm-hmm. That's important, right? I think about another famously quote-unquote bad ending that I adore, which is Neon Genesis Evangelion. That ending is completely bonkers. I love it because it closes the emotional arc like Lost for you. But it also is that way because they ran out of money and time, right? And so they weren't able to signal we're doing this on purpose because... Yeah. Quite frankly, they weren't doing it on purpose. I think they did something incredible that works. But, you know, it is the hand-holding component. It is the we know we're breaking a rule. We know you expected X. We're going to give you Y. Trust us and go with it. And when that doesn't happen, I think that's when it feels like a mistake.
And I actually think that's why it's so important to actually learn more. Like, I'm really excited to learn more about the plot structures. Because what you don't want to have happen is everyone is aware, whether intentionally or unintentionally, of a particular plot thing that you are doing.
Yeah.
And then you don't know that that's what you're doing. So you break away from it without signaling, like somebody who goes across 8 lanes of highway without signaling. And you're like, oh my gosh, now you've caused an accident. What is happening? And I want to know what those rules are so that I can break them intentionally.
And I think it's actually, in some cases, less about signaling and understanding the ripple effects of the decision you made.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and sort of building on that, it's when we say rules, there's not a committee sitting somewhere that's being like, here are the rules of fiction. If you follow them, you will be fined. Humans are creatures of pattern recognition, right? All storytelling is pattern recognition. We're seeing the same rhythms. We have the same expectations of like, oh, here's what happens in a story because of all the other ones we've experienced, all the other ones that we've observed, right? And so when we talk about different story structures, when we talk about different expectations, whether that's, you know, 3-act structure, 7-point plot structure, you know, non-Western structures, all these different things, That is because over time, people had developed certain expectations by observing certain patterns over and over again. So when you are breaking with that expectation, when you're breaking that pattern, knowing what other patterns there are in moving from pattern A to pattern B, or just even inverting the pattern on purpose, becomes really important so that you're not just chaotically wandering off the path and then it doesn't match to anything we know.
Let me give you a really concrete example of this kind of thing, which is the rule of three. So you hear it all the time. Three times is funny. Third time, three times is, you know, bad things come in three. Good things come in three. Three things is, you know, three times is funny. All of those are this expectation in Western culture that it's going to be one, two, three, got it. In some other cultures, it's rule of five, rule of seven. I think there's one that's rule of 11 where I'm like, ooh, those are long evenings. Yeah. But once you know that the audience is expecting this dun, 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 got it. If you've been watching media and it's like, this is very predictable, it's probably because they've been doing rule of three every time. And so you can manipulate that. If you want something to feel harder for a character, then you can go to a rule of four or five, you know, that they have to put in four or five efforts. If you want it to be easier, you can do a rule of one or two. You can even have the character go into it expecting it to be hard, get it on the first try, and have them be like, oh my goodness, you know, that there's this big cathartic release that they were not expecting. The reader wasn't expecting it because they're expecting this buildup to it. So if you know that, then you go in and you consciously break the rule of three for the effect because you know what the audience expectations are. That's the kind of thing where I'm like, you don't have to signal it, but you just have to know what the ripple effects are.
Exactly, exactly. So you can set up the pattern and then break it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what I love about when you mention them all is that while there are maybe some that don't fit into this, it's very odd numbers. So I actually think the desire for things to be in odd numbers is like a human brain thing that goes across cultures. But some go five, some go seven, some go nine, but it's rarer to have like six for some reason. Like, I don't know why our brains are like this. What I think is interesting is like just knowing that like there's a discomfort in things ending in an even way. It's like the fourth one was the one that you ended up with. Like maybe something is wrong about this can make you like if in fact you wanted to secretly be the fifth, the fourth seems right, but in fact, something is wrong there.
Yeah.
You can actually, like, when you understand these patterns, it's like you can subconsciously create things going on that even the reader, like, won't understand why it feels off, but it just does.
You can deliberately unsettle. You can make things feel unfinished, like the core doesn't resolve. And then, you know, if you're telling a horror story, if you're telling something psychologically upsetting, make it four. Four feels bad. I don't know why, but it does.
It's death. Yeah. So this is the kind of thing that we're going to be talking about this season. In addition to that, what we are also going to be doing is we are going to be taking plot structures like the three-act structure, the hero's journey, the heroine's journey, the four-act structure. Like we're going to be looking at a bunch of different, very specific plot structures and taking them apart and going, well, why does this work? Mm-hmm. Why do we have to have that thing here? So those are the things that we're going to be doing this season. So for your homework, what I want you to do is I want you to grab something that you like, and I want you to kind of look at it and do, we've talked about doing reverse engineer of outlines before. I want you to do that with this, but in a kind of very gentle way. I just want you to go through and say, scene good, scene bad. Like, good thing happen, bad thing happen as the overall takeaway from the scene. And look to see if there's a pattern that you did not realize was in that work. This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write. Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. Your hosts for this episode were Mary Robinette Kowal, Don Juan Song, and Aaron Roberts. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.